Well, we don't do a very good job of nutrition here in the United States, which probably accounts for the prevalence of obesity in the population and not just among adults. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In a lot of cases, we seem to be controlled by our food rather than the other way around. Well, there's a new book titled Food, You're the Boss, Put It to Work for You, and it offers some ways for us to take charge of our nutrition. And we have its author with us this morning. My guest this hour is Gary Epler, pulmonary consultant at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, author of Food, You're the Boss, Put It to Work for You. Good morning, Dr. Epler, and welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Program.
John, it's just great to be here this morning.
All right. One of the things that caught my attention, in fact, it was the two words that caused me to forward an email I got about your book to the producers of this program, and that is the concept of the belly brain. I immediately did a Google search for that and was amazed at the number of hits I got, including a rather interesting article in Scientific American. But we seem to have this whole other brain that has something to do with the way we eat and what we eat. And I'd like to start there because that was my point of curiosity. What is our belly brain?
John, that's a good place to start. We've known about it for centuries. And in medical school, we learn about the enteric nervous system, a fancy word, but it just means a nervous system in the abdomen that controls digestion. And there are more nerves, nerve endings, and neurotransmitters as there are in the spinal cord. So there's tons of information coming and tons of information going.
So most of us don't understand how our brains work anyway. At least I know I don't, but I'm just hoping it does work on a daily basis. We assume that all the commands that control our entire body come directly from our brain, and they go out and tell everything else in our bodies what to do. As I understand it, though, the belly brain is in some ways kind of on its own.
It is, and not only that, we always think of our brain and our heads, and they control our bodies, but think about the old sayings, I have a good or bad gut feeling about something. I mean, that's been around a long time, and you've had it, I've had it. We all had this gut feeling about something. Well, that's real. And in Eastern cultures, if you ask people about where they think from, they tap on their bellies. And so it is a real powerful thing. And we're just starting now to learn how powerful it is.
You mention in your book in relationship to this that this enteric nervous system or belly brain, as we've euphemistically called it, helps us. We respond to different types of foods. For example, we might smell one thing and we have one kind of response, and we might smell something else and our stomach gives us a different reaction. Explain how that works.
And that's exactly it. We can try it right this minute. Think in terms of a greasy food. Just sort of visualize that. Think about that with your head brain and your stomach. Your stomach is just saying, oh, no, I don't want that. And at the same time, think of then a banana. Well, okay, that's all calm down there. And so it may not speak English, but emotionally, it's certainly speaking to you.
How
you can use it.
Well, this explains my problem then, because I thought of a greasy food and my mouth watered, and the banana didn't seem like such a great option. So,
maybe my belly brain
needs to go to counseling so that it can get itself straightened out here.
That's a good one. That's okay. Good.
I have a good friend who is very attracted to the odor of the friolator at the local cafe. So
that's right.
Maybe some of us aren't wired quite right, and that would explain a lot. Well, one of the things you point out is we often feel like we are more or less dominated by our food. In fact, you go so far as to describe in your book that this is actually like a dominant submissive relationship, and food is in charge. How did we get to that? I mean, you know, if you look at the just in the United States, the time when the frontier was expanding and we had people living in largely rural areas, and they the question was, did they have enough to eat? Did they have enough calories? Not did they have too many? And obese people were rare. To a situation where obesity is epidemic and food is in charge. How did we get to that point?
It began actually in the 50s, 40s, 50s, after the World War II, and it's the conditioning through television is a huge one, and magazines and advertising, billboards. It just all began because it started advertising foods. And the foods really, really tasted good. And they were salty foods, and they're sugary foods. And they taste really good. And they became so ubiquitous. I mean, they're everywhere. For example, if you're riding on the highway and you stop by a gas station with their little market, every food in there, it's really hard to find a healthy one. And they're cheap. And it's almost, and the same with restaurants. Restaurants have become so good and so inexpensive that it's easier to, almost to go to a restaurant than it is to buy foods. And the issue with restaurants is lots of salty foods and high carbohydrate foods.
Not to mention the portion sizes, which have become increasingly large.
Oh, you really, they've been huge. Fortunately, my wife and I sort of always split things, and it comes down to sort of a reasonable amount. But that's all. That's why it's through conditioning and through advertising, and that's in food availability. It's everywhere.
Well, and it seems that, and as I've been doing a little bit of reading, not just your book, but others and articles and so forth, and just personal experience, we eat when we're not even hungry. Eating has become a form of recreation.
It has. It has. Absolutely has. And the only way, not the only way, but the way to approach it is use of the mind. And willpower is not enough. And you just have to use the mind. And there's three ways to use the mind.
Okay. Tell us what those are.
Oh, the first one's a little tricky, but it's using the alpha and theta brain waves. These are brain waves that are slow brain waves. You sort of have to learn how to use them. You can do meditation or some other ways. But once you figure out how to use those alpha and theta brain waves, then you can sort of program the mind. You train the mind. You just train the mind to eat the right foods and the right amounts at the right time. And so that's one way. The second way is it's to use what I call eat to high energy level. And when you have a meal, again, this has been known for centuries, and when you have a meal, it brings energy. Food is energy. It's fuel. And there comes a point in that meal that starts to decrease. The energy level starts to dive. It gets to the point where there's this stuffed feeling, this feeling like Thanksgiving or holiday feasts. You just want to go lie down. And you just have to train the mind not to get to that level. Train the mind to get to that high energy level and stop eating.
Well, how do you do that? How do you train your mind? And particularly your first point about the alpha and theta waves in our brains, how do we go about doing that?
Well, the alpha and the theta brain, the waves, you have to learn to use those. And meditation is a way to begin to learn them. Once you learn them, you don't have to do that. And then once you've learned them, then you go into those alpha and theta wavelengths, relaxing, very relaxing state, and just program the mind to pick the right carbohydrates and the right amount. And that's how that one's done. As far as the high energy, it's a feeling. It's a feeling, and we talked about the belly brain. It's a feeling that, yes, this is it. This is very subtle. It's a very subtle feeling. But this is a high energy level. This is perfect. and just stop eating at that time.
Mm-hmm. And so, again, what's the third? What's the third thing then that we need to do here?
Is stress, and you have to use the mind to decrease stress, and it's important to know why is stress going to be a problem, and this is what happens during stress. Cortisol is released. And cortisol is an adrenal hormone from the adrenal glands. It's a neurotransmitter, and it shuts down digestion, moves all of the bloodstream and all of the energy to the muscles and to the heart, because it's the old-fashioned flee or fight response that's been known about for centuries. And when that happens, digestion comes to an end, cortisol goes up, and cortisol has a function of storing fat. And it stores it in the abdominal receptors. And so it's just what it does. And so under stress, this is what happens. And so if someone eats in that situation, then number one, the digestion shut down. It's not going to convert that food to energy. It's going to convert it to storage. It's going to convert it to fat. And so the third thing is to decrease the stress of life in general. But specifically, one way to do it before a meal is to take three or four what I call belly breaths. You want to know about belly breaths?
Yes, I do.
John, they really work. First time I heard them, I thought they were nuts. But it actually triggers a reflex. A belly breath's real simple. Put your hand on your belly and take a breath and have your hand go out. It usually goes in. So do the opposite. Have your hand go out and then blow out and then have the hand go in. All you need is three or four of these. And it triggers a reflex, a calming reflex. And so that's very helpful in a stressful situation. It works before a meal. It works before somebody has to give a talk or something like that. But for a meal, it really does. It helps calm the whole system, and you get back into that parasympathetic system, which is the opposite of the sympathetic one. And it turns on the digestion, and it's very efficient.
Sounds like the kinds of cleansing breaths that pregnant women are told to take in various phases of labor, and probably for much the same reason. We're talking about the book Food, You're the Boss, Put It to Work for You, 5 Steps to Take Charge of Your Nutrition with Gary Epler, a pulmonary consultant at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, author of the book under discussion this hour. If you've got questions about nutrition, about gaining control of your own nutrition, anything related to that, now would be a great time for you to call, because we have an expert here who can give you some concrete answers and some steps that you can take to be a healthier individual. Here's the way to get in touch, 800-642-1234. That's the phone number to use if you'd like to be on the air with our program today, 800-642-1234. Email works just as well. You can send a message to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And the Kathleen Dunn program is also on Facebook. You can find it there and leave your comment or question for Dr. Epler that way. Okay, so 800-642-1234. Let's see who has questions for the doctor about nutrition and gaining control of the way we eat and the health benefits that will accrue from that. And we'll talk about some of those health benefits and so forth coming up in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. This hour we're talking about nutrition and how we can gain control of our own nutrition. Oftentimes food seems to be in charge of our lives. I don't know about you, but it certainly seems true for me on some days, worse than others. But I think many of us may be in this category. And if you're not, maybe you could share how that works for you. But there's a book out titled Food, You're the Boss, put it to work for you. And we have Dr. Gary Empler with us to talk about that book and about ways that we can put ourselves back in charge of our own nutrition. If you'd like to join us with a comment or question, 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234, lines available right now. If you'd prefer, you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or as I said earlier, you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook. Doctor, there are thousands of diet programs, diet pills, diet potions, diet additives, diet this, diet that on the market today. Most of us have tried at least a dozen of them. And I would say in most cases without success, or if we do have some success, it's short term. And then failure sets in. Why is it that most of these plans, as well-intentioned as they may be, end up being failures?
Well, John, when it turns out that diets are probably the biggest weight gain program in the United States and probably in Canada as well. And what happens is that people will follow the diet for 3 or 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 2 months and lose 20 or 30 pounds. And, John, you know what's going to happen? They're going to get off that thing. About a year later, they're going to gain 35 pounds. And then they cycle again. They lose the 30, but then they gain 40. And over a 10-year period, there's a giant problem. So diets, for the most part, and there's going to be another 100 of them tomorrow and the next day, they generally don't work. And the reason, it's probably, again, conditioning. We've been conditioned to eat certain foods and certain amounts for 20 or 30, 40 years. And again, all of the availability is just too much. they're just not going to work over time. I talk about learning about carbohydrates and learning about the low, what I call low threshold carbohydrates, and then putting the mind to work and learn about it and follow through with it, and it'll work. But it takes a long time. And if somebody is in the 50-pound to 100-pound overweight range or 150, they can't do it alone. You really have to have support. And I think that's the main thing. And I talk about step three of monitoring nutrition. And somebody has to help an individual if that's the kind of weight they need to lose. And they can do it through a physician, but a nutritionist is really perfect. It's less expensive, and you just need someone to say, well, do it this way, or use these choices, or your monitoring, just to help things along.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing in these situations, it's going to be a 3 to 5 year program minimum, and maybe even 10. But 10 years is worth it because there's another 40 years of life left. If a person is at healthy weight, that 40 years is going to be fantastic. There's not going to be diabetes. There's not going to be hypertension, heart disease, and it's worth those 10 years.
Well, and what you're really talking about, though, is a lifelong change in lifestyle. I mean, in habits, developing a whole new set of habits and then maintaining those, not just for the length of time it might take to lose whatever weight a person has to lose, but permanently making good choices in the long term rather than, okay, I took off that weight, now I can go back to having 3 slices of apple pie for dessert.
You could not have said it better. Absolutely what is needed.
Okay. We have callers who are lined up to ask questions or make comments. Let's start in Woodruff and hear from Rosie this morning. Rosie, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered if the doctor could speak briefly about, I didn't realize that there was a nervous system in the belly, and I have a problem with what's been called gastroparesis, and I'm waiting to see a GI specialist on this. I'm sort of having the opposite problem where the stomach is not responding or moving properly, and I understand now that that may have something to do with nerves down there. If he could speak about maybe what one could do to sort of re-stimulate the nervous system or get that going again. And part of my question is also that although I am extremely nauseous all the time and can barely eat any food, I continue to gain weight in my lower belly more and more, and having been told to eat a low-residue diet, which is all white, and to me that's counterintuitive, that you need fiber and things to move along. So I just wondered if you could speak about that a little bit.
Boy, you hit something. Gastroparesis, that is a definitely, it is just what the word sounds like. Gastro means stomach, and paresis actually means, well, paralysis to the far extent, but it means weakness. And it's an unusual situation, but that's exactly what you have, is the stomach is just not emptying out. And as a result, you're going to get nausea and so forth and all these symptoms that you've described. And fortunately, you're going to be visiting a gastroenterologist. Is that true, Rosie?
Been given medication, the metacyclopramide or whatever, which worked for a very short time, and then just completely quit working altogether, no result at all. That's why I'm going to see the GI, and I'm told that there's really no other medication to get that stimulated along, so that was
right.
Another question for you.
And this is a new gastroenterologist?
Yes, this will be my first time seeing him, but this has been going on for about 4 months.
Right, so you'll get a new perspective.
Yes, sir.
And be sure, when you see him, the main thing to do is ask lots of questions.
Okay.
And ask questions about what caused it, and ask questions about the treatment management, about the management, and pills. If pills are suggested, well, what are the side effects of pills? What is the chance that those pills will work? Will the pills stop working? So you make sure you ask all those questions. And another one is ask what happens if you don't do anything. It's always, you might get an interesting answer, so that's important to find out. And then ask about non-medication treatments and diet and nutrition. What can you do for the diet? It's like you just said, someone said to eat lots of white, starchy foods and low-residue foods. That doesn't sound like the thing to do. I just sort of intuitively doesn't sound like the thing to do. So make sure to ask him, well, what foods are good? And those are the main things that you can get out of that evaluation.
Rosie, thanks for the call and good luck. Let's go to Tim in Green Bay next.
Hi.
Hi, Tim. Good morning.
How about a comment?
Sure, go ahead.
Just having major stress in one's life is a contributing factor to just eating and then gaining weight?
Tim, you're 100% right.
Thank you.
It is.
Because that's kind of what I'm going through right now. I'm 5'9 and weigh 170 pounds, but I'm just going through a lot of stuff right now, and it gets very irritating, and you find myself eating, and there goes the weight.
There goes the weight. Yeah, that is huge, especially all through America and Canada. I mean, that's a big issue. And so then you have to say, well, all right, so what can I do about that? Personally, I tell you, my best solution, you may not like it, but I exercise a lot. I work out every day, and I run a lot. I've been doing it for a long time. I have gotten so stressed, I can't even see straight. I go out, start running, and I just run a mile. I run 2 miles. I run 3 miles. I am still stressed. I run 4 miles, and I'm almost a little bit less stressed, and then all of a sudden, at mile 5, mile 6, boom, I absolutely have no stress. Whatever it was that caused that stress, it was somebody insulted I remember I was in Japan and somebody insulted the disease that I described and they said we had to eliminate it and I was so upset about that. But I got over it. After 5 or 6 miles, I could care less. And so exercise is phenomenal at getting rid of stress and just keep going until the stress is gone. And the physiology, the science behind that is these little endorphins start to develop, and endorphins are a chemical that calms things, and it doesn't get rid of pain, but it says, I don't care anymore, and it's very helpful.
Well, the endorphin rush is one of the big benefits, immediate benefits that people see from exercise. Obviously, there are some longer term benefits of improved cardiorespiratory function and strength and so forth. But that endorphin rush, boy, that's a great feeling when you get done with a workout and your body is tired, but your brain is just alive with energy, and you just feel really good.
John, you do. And for stress, it's just fantastic.
Well, Tim, good luck with your stressful situation. But a lot, as you point out, Doctor, a lot of Americans right now, particularly with the economy and things being the way they are, there's a lot of uncertainty out there. A lot of people are afraid. A lot of people are very upset by one thing or another. People are unemployed. They're poor. Maybe they have a job, but they're worried about losing it. We have a lot going on that's external. It's not necessarily of our own making. We aren't drumming this stuff up on our own. So perhaps being aware of that and its physiological effects is the first step to helping us take control of that situation and doing some of these kinds of things that you talk about in your book.
And that is you have to be in charge. And situations, I mean, it's always going to happen. The economy, this, that, and the stress, it's always going to be there. It's a healthy thing. It's just you have to be in charge of it. You can't let it suck you into the negative side of it.
Is that what you mean? Is that what you mean by the power of the mind-body balance?
Exactly. Exactly that.
Exactly that. Okay. Let's talk some specifics here about what kinds of foods we should be eating and some things that we should avoid. And we probably all have a fairly good idea of what this is, but I think it's good to be reminded. What do you recommend that we consume?
Sure, it is something we all know about. We've learned about it in grade school, high school, all schools. We read about it in the paper. We see it from government agencies all the time. We know them, and I'll just repeat them because it really, the more you know, the better it is. There's three things. You got carbohydrates, fats, and proteins. Let's start with the carbohydrates. We need them, no question about it. And there are two kinds. There are low-threshold carbohydrates and high-threshold carbohydrates. Low-threshold carbohydrates mean that you can't eat very much. And if you eat over that threshold, they're going to be harmful. They're either going to add fat or they're going to cause inflamed arteries. And those high-threshold foods, carbohydrates, won't do a thing. You can eat just almost as much as you want. Now, going back to the low ones, you know what they are. Starting out with those sugary foods, and sugar itself is probably the worst possible thing. The science behind it, lots of sugar, lots of sugary foods. Up goes the insulin very quickly. Insulin shoots up, it's in the bloodstream, and it takes care of that sugar. It drops it down to its normal level, but it's so high that a lot of it goes to storage. And the storage floats around the bloodstream in the form of triglycerides. And triglycerides are actually more dangerous than cholesterol. They injure the arterial walls. Low levels, not a problem. High levels, they cause injury to the arterial walls. So those are the low-threshold carbohydrates, sugar, sugary drinks, the starches, pasta, even potatoes, rice is even in that group, and the baked goods, processed goods, all of those kind of carbohydrates are what I call the low-threshold. They cause insulin surge. Insulin surge causes that fat, triglyceride into elevation, and at the same time, it causes cortisol release, and we've talked about what cortisol does. It just deposits that fat in the middle. So that's carbohydrates. So you have a choice. Stick with the high threshold, and there you go, vegetables, spinach, broccoli, carrots, those kind of things, fruit. The sugar in fruit's called fructose, and it's metabolized in the liver. And it does not cause insulin surge or cortisol release. And so that's why fruits are reasonable. You can't eat too many of them, but they're certainly healthy without causing problems. And other one is fiber. And that's a carbohydrate. And in the Western societies, we tend to have too small amount of fiber. And it's very important to eat really, you can have a lot of fiber. It's just not going to harm anyone. And so those are the big carbohydrates. You ready?
Yep.
You with me?
Yep.
So those are really, if someone has a kind of a men maybe have a belly they want to get rid of, 20, 30 pounds of belly hanging there, it's the carbs. It really is. It's the wrong quantity of carbs. And women want to lose their 10, 20 pounds, it's the carbs. And it's usually the white, the starchy ones, the sugary things, the baked goods. Just keep them to a small amount. So,
what about fats?
What about fats? Fats, the issue with fats is they don't cause you to get fat. The problem with fats is that the saturated fats, the ones found in fried foods and the ones found in the white fats and lard and those kind of things, and bacon, the thing that those fats do is circulate around the bloodstream. They hook up with proteins, circulate around the bloodstream in low-density lipoproteins are called, and they injure the blood vessels, and they injure the blood vessels to the heart, and that's where the issue is with fats. Saturated fats at very tiny levels actually don't hurt, but it doesn't take much, just a tiny bit, and you go over that level. On the other hand, unsaturated fats, those are the omega-3s that you've heard about, salmon and other things, those are healthy, and they actually decrease that anti-inflammatory response.
Okay.
The last one. Oops.
Yeah, go ahead.
Proteins. Proteins are all good. They're fantastic. The only thing you have to be careful about with proteins is their company that they keep. For example, a lean chicken is fantastic. There's nothing wrong with it, especially if you have the free-range lean chicken. That is not going to be harmful. It's a great source of protein. But if you add skin, if you add a little batter, if you throw them in a frying pan, in this wonderful fried chicken, oh, now you've gotten into a problem. So that's the thing with proteins, but proteins are fantastic.
All right. We have an email from Patty in Verona, and I think this goes directly to something you spoke about toward the beginning of the program. She writes, if I am eating mindfully, fully present in the moment, enjoying food, enjoying conversation, etc., I notice a sensation when I take the next bite that I've interpreted to be a blood sugar reaction, an experience of blood sugar elevation. If I attend to that sensation and take it as my clue that I've had enough and stop eating, I'll feel great, that is, energized after the meal. On the other hand, if I ignore this signal or I am too distracted to even notice it, I usually experience that dive in energy following the meal. I've understood this to be a function of the lag between the body being full and the brain getting the message, about 20 minutes. Are there other signals Dr. Epler could advise people to look for as they reach that optimal high energy level?
John, Veronica ought to get a Nobel Prize for that. That is fantastic, what she just said. Did you understand what she said about the?
Well, I was waiting for you to interpret it for me, but this is what you talked about, knowing when to stop and maintaining that high energy feeling and then eating too much and losing it. But what she really wants to know here is, are there other clues?
Right. I mean,
that
clue
we can use.
Fantastic. I mean, that's unbelievable. She actually feels the glucose being increased in that. It's exactly what you don't want to happen. And that's fantastic that she's got that. I mean, I'll have to tell people about that one.
But are there other clues that we can pick up?
The other clue is it's a feeling, and that's what I say. It's a subtle feeling. It's a subtle feeling that you've experienced, I've experienced, we've all experienced it. You just have to think about it. And it's a feeling in the belly and in the mind. It's actually more in the mind than the belly. But it's a feeling of energy. You just get to a point where this is it. This is just fantastic energy. I feel good. If this is going to keep me going for another 3 or 4 hours. And then if you go over that, oops, you just lose it. And so all I can say is it's a feeling. And
but
her concept of a feeling of, well, it's glucose, that is a feeling.
Okay, Patty and Verona, thank you so much for your comment there. You know, one of the things that's probably going on here, though, at least perhaps in those of us of a certain age or part of a certain generation, is that a lot of us grew up being encouraged to be members of what our mothers called the Clean Plate Club. And not only that, you have to finish what's on your plate, and then as your reward, here's a nice sugary dessert for you. Which, you know, since mother labored so long making it, you'd darn well better eat it. But the idea is whatever's on our plate, we have to finish all of it, and then we have to have dessert. And that's a cultural thing.
John, that is absolutely right. I mean, that's conditioning. And we have been conditioned that way, to clean our plate, to eat that wonderful dessert, because your mom did it. I absolutely agree with you. And the only way, not the only again, but a way to get over that is just, I use small plates. That's sort of helpful. And don't have a second helping. You just do not need a second helping, never. Even though you may feel like you do, it's your mind hasn't caught up yet with that energy level. And the third thing is just take small portions, and that's really the way to get around it.
All right, let's see. I think let's take a break. When we come back, we've got some more callers who want to join us and one who has a question about artificial sweeteners. I'd like to hear the answer to that one myself, and we've got some other people lined up here as well. We're talking with Gary Epler, MD, who is a pulmonary consultant at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he's the author of the book Food, You're the Boss. Put it to work for you. We'll be back with more with Dr. Epler and your calls and questions in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. We're talking about the book Food, You're the Boss with Dr. Gary Epler and with you. Dr. Epler, we have some callers who have some questions. Let's start with Joe in Appleton. Joe, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was doing some research on how your body burns fat, and I came across an article that said that fat was handled or processed by your liver, and that but your liver is also responsible for processing toxins. And so if your liver is overladen with toxins, it doesn't get to the fat because it chooses to process the toxins first to get them out of your system. And people that drink a lot of diet soda, especially sodas with aspartame, your body recognizes that as a toxin and processes it through your liver so that it has the effect of actually causing you to store fat as opposed to process fat. I wanted to know, number one, if you've heard that, if you think that's true, and number two, what you think of some of the newer artificial sweeteners that are actually naturally derived, like sucralose.
You know, Joe, that's a real excellent comment, and I have read what you read, and my initial reaction is that it's possible. It sounds scientifically possible that the liver is going to handle toxins before it handles fat digestion. Is what I like to see on those is scientific studies, and I like to see 95% confidence intervals and all that kind of thing. It's possible. That's all I could say as far as that one goes. The second, as far as artificial sweeteners, my overall reaction is just to try to absolutely decrease the use of those of any kind. That's my main thing. As far as the natural occurring ones over the non-natural occurring ones, not necessarily true. They both may react the same way. Again, you have to look at the studies to find out.
So you recommend that we not use artificial sweeteners?
I'm not one for those. Number one is they make it easy to have these big, huge sodas. And a 24, 42-ounce soda is just dangerous. It's carbonic acid yeah, there are no calories in there, but it's carbonic acid. Carbonic acid is not good for the teeth, not good for the gums, and gum disease, teeth decay is a real problem. And if it's almost to the point where the only safe thing to drink is water, and it, because so many of these low-calorie drinks are just, they're not healthy. They're just not good for the system.
Okay. Joe, thanks for that call. Here's a comment from Peter in Madison. Actually, it's a question. Peter in Madison asks, some people must avoid fructose, many vegetables, added fiber, lactose, or legumes. What should they eat? And what if physical disabilities inhibit running or similar fun forms of exercise?
The first part has to do with some people that have to avoid certain things. I'm talking primarily about, I'm probably talking about 90-95% of the population when I discuss things. There are exceptions, and there are disorders, there are metabolic disorders, hundreds, if not thousands of metabolic disorders that people cannot have fructose, they cannot have certain types of medications and certain types of foods. There's just no question about it. And the only response I can say is that those are individual cases that have to be approached in an individual manner.
Probably
with
he was concerned about what people who had a disability could do for exercise if they couldn't run.
Now, that the disability, that's a big term, is what you can always exercise. I have a personal trainer that I sort of work out just to do some muscle work once a week because it just feels good. And I've been doing that for a long time, and I always am injuring something, either a low back pain or a foot. We always do. We always injure something. He says, we'll work around it. And that's really what you do. If a person is absent a leg, there's tons of ways to work out. If they're absent an arm or if it's just low back pain, whatever it is, there's ways to work around it. Not only that, but certain types of exercise, these kettlebell exercise, has actually been a study to show that it decreases pain, low back pain, and neck pain and shoulder pain if it's done correctly.
All right, Peter, thanks thanks for your question. Let's go to Stella in Sturgeon Bay next. Stella, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question, and I also have a suggestion. The question is regarding when you went through the carbohydrates, when you went through the food groups, and you mentioned carbohydrates and low-threshold carbohydrates, you said pasta and rice. My question is, are you referring there to white pasta and white rice, and is whole grain pasta and brown rice a different cat? Is it different?
A very, very good question. I was just thinking about that this morning. Whole grains are great. And the reason is they don't cause what we call this glycemic reaction. They don't cause an insulin surge. And it'd be the same with rice. So any substance, any of those carbohydrates, those white starchy ones, that don't cause insulin surge are safe. They're good to have.
Okay. And my comment is, or suggestion is, this summer, my husband and I have got turned on to a wonderfully refreshing drink, which is we pick fresh mint, we steep it in hot water, and then we put it in a half-gallon jar in the refrigerator and keep it cold. And it's just purified, reverse osmosis, purified water and steeped mint. We take the leaves out after we've steeped them, and it's mint water. And it's delicious and refreshing and cooling.
That's a good, great suggestion. It certainly beats those awful drinks I told you about, those ones with those artificial sweeteners. You reminded me now. I have to tell a story about artificial sweeteners. Is it okay, John?
Go ahead.
Quick story. My wife noticed one of she was working with someone, and about 10 o'clock, she had just turned cranky. She would just be nasty. She was grumpy. And my wife said, what's going on? And she says, in the morning, I have two big sodas. You know, these low-calorie sodas, those one-calorie sodas with all that artificial flavoring. And geez, that doesn't sound right, but why would it cause this? And it turns out that in her situation, that her brain, her mind, interpreted that sweetness as sugar. And insulin went up. And 90 minutes later, she was hypoglycemic because she didn't have any sugar in the bloodstream. And so the insulin worked on what sugar there was, and that was normal. And so down it went. And she was running a blood sugar of about 55 or 60, and she was hypoglycemic. And so I said, is this really true? Because I have to, everything I say in this book, I've got to confirm scientifically. And I looked it up, and they've tested maybe 7, 8, 10 of these, and sure enough, one or two of them actually can do that to the mind.
Hmm. Boy, I'm going to have to change my daily routine.
There you go, John.
One of the things that you talk about in your book is a nutrition inventory. What is that, and how do we do it?
Sure, and nutrition inventory is just what it sounds like. Where do you stand? And there's three things to do. One, what's the weight? And then find out if that's in the kind of healthy weight for height and age. Number two is measure the circumference of the waist at the belly button. And that one, it turns out, is a risk factor for diabetes and hypertension. And if it's over 40 in men, over 35 in women, that means that there's risk. Doesn't mean they're going to get that, but it certainly means risk. So that's the second one. Third one is percent body fat. And that's a little trickier to measure. There's calibers that you can measure where these workout clubs have them, and there's other ways at the internet. There's four or five measurements you can plug in, and it'll give you percent of body weight. And for men, it should really be less than 20%, and for women, less than 25%. On the other hand, if you're in the 20s, it's okay, but above the 30s, it is going to be a problem.
Okay. Well, the other test here is if you're standing up straight and can't see your toes, you're in trouble.
John. That's going to take some support. You're going to need somebody to keep things along there.
You do list in the title of your book, it talks about 5 steps to take charge of your nutrition, and we've got about 4 minutes left. So let's run through what those 5 steps are to make sure everybody knows what we're talking about.
Okay, and these 4 minutes, because I've got a little story I've got to finish up with. It'll make you feel good. It can make you feel good. The first step is learn absolutely everything you can about food and just keep learning about it, because it's always new. There's always new foods. There's always new things happening. Number two is to understand the diagnostic process, and that's what I told about the woman, that Rosie, I think, that had that disease. You just ask lots and lots of questions about diagnostic tests and what they're for, and do they really help. And same with, and the third one is treatment options. There's diets, there's surgery, there's all types of management. Look into those and ask for the risks. What are the risks? And not only the short term, but what are the 10, 20-year risks to some of these programs? And the fourth one is monitor it. Monitor the weight. Monitor that circumference and record it. And the fifth is use the mind. And that fifth one is really powerful, and that's what we've talked about. So, John, I got to tell you something before we leave.
Okay.
John, you can break the rules. Here are 3 things to do if you break the rules. Number one, don't do it very often. Number two, watch the quantity. But absolutely the most important thing is rule number 3. If you break them, enjoy it. Enjoy every single bite. If you got that hot fudge sundae, don't make it very big. But if you've got it there, just enjoy every single bite. Do not feel guilty. Do not feel stressed. Do not say, oh, I shouldn't do this. I shouldn't do this, and take a bite. What's that doing? Stress, right? Stress is going to stop the digestion system. All that wonderful thing you're breaking is just going to go to fat, right? So there it is, John. Break the rules.
Okay, well, you did. I mean, unfortunately, that point came up in the last minute of the program here, but there is a real connection between feeling guilty about having eaten something bad and then eating more of the same thing because you're feeling guilty.
Worse. It's cortisol. Cortisol comes out. There's no question. Cortisol's out.
Okay.
That digestion just comes to a quit, stop, and it just goes to storage. And
wow.
So enjoy it, John. Break the rules,
okay.
But absolutely enjoy every single bite.
Well, I have a package of watermelon waiting for me when I get off the air here, Doctor. So I think I'll be having a healthy snack. Thank you so much for sharing this hour with us. I really appreciate it. I know our audience found it informative and nutritious. Appreciate it.
Great, John. Wonderful to talk to you.
Gary Epler is a pulmonary consultant at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's the author of the book, Food, You're the Boss, Put It to Work for You. And if you'd like to know more about this, if there were some things that we didn't cover today, there is a website, www.eplerhealth.com, and there's a link to that, both on the Kathleen Dunn page on WPR's website or on Facebook. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers. Join us again tomorrow at 10. We'll be joined by David Weigel, political reporter for Slate, about super PACs. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn.